Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, Mr. Pfeiffer.
From the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel.
Tell me what you really think about Daddy.
He's a bear.
He's not a bear. He's not innocent like that.
I know what Rose says, Jenny, about your dad.
Oh, he's respected. And people say what bitches we are.
Threw a man off his own farm on a knife. He wouldn't keep a wolf on him.
Think you can treat me like this?
You think this is bad, Daddy? You'd be amazed at what you really deserve.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pfeiffer Fridays, where we walk you through the films of one Michelle Pfeiffer, and every F-word automatically has a silent P. I'm Jerry Downey.
And I'm Michael McLean.
And today we are covering 1997's A Thousand Acres, starring Jessica Lange, Jason Robards, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Colin Firth, Keith Carradine, Kevin Anderson, baby Michelle Williams and Elizabeth Moss, and of course, La Pfeiffer as Rose Cook Lewis. So, Mr. McLean, this was a first watch for you, correct?
Yes, it sure was. I think you were looking forward to me watching this one. Was this one of...
I probably was.
Okay.
I feel like there's lots of opinions on this one, so I was very excited to get your opinion on this one.
Okay, alrighty. Not for any reason. This is definitely not a campy classic. This is not anything fun and light and frothy. So yeah, I remember you saying this, you know, just wait for A Thousand Acres and thinking, oh, this must be just a schmackty, you know. I don't know. I think I had if you give the title A Thousand Acres and you put like on your poster, you have like a farmhouse, I'm just picturing maybe like a melodrama, like Places in the Heart, something a little bit more rustic and, you know, waiting for my husband to return from war. Maybe something like that. I think that's what I was expecting.
All right.
That's not what we thought.
Yeah, I was about to say that you did not get what was mentally promised to you.
No. But this movie is also very difficult to track down.
Right, because I got mine from the library.
Yeah.
God bless the public library, because I knew, I Could Never Be Your Woman and Thousand Acres were the last two that I did not own in any way, shape, or fashion. All the rest that we're doing, I own in some way. So yeah, I just had it on my shelf, and I think this is the first SOS text I've ever received from you about a movie.
Yeah, because it's not, I couldn't find it anywhere. I was prepared to, I would have bought it, you know, if the only option was buying it, sure. You can't rent it anywhere. It's so funny. But luckily through your secret ways.
Other means,
we found it. But I was worried. I thought we were not going to be a completionist podcast. Or I would have had to go to Chicago.
Yeah.
Watch it with you.
And which you would have been more than welcome.
Thank you. I'm vaccinated, so just so you know.
Yeah, come to Chicago. We'll watch A Thousand Acres together. It'll be fun.
Yes. Yes, we found it. SOS has been answered. We're all good now. But yeah, it was a really wild ride of a viewing experience, and it's definitely grown on me in some ways since I've watched it, especially the performances, especially with Jessica and Michelle's performances. I rewatched a few scenes before we got on today just to reacquaint myself, remember. There are some scenes I really remember pretty vividly, but there are some, like the one where they're getting drunk on the side of the road.
Yeah.
There's the scene in the Denny's. We'll talk about these scenes, but just I rewatched them just to get my brain back in the Thousand Acres land, and really effective stuff.
Yeah. It is an actress showcase.
Yeah. And yeah, sometimes sometimes you're just in the mood for it. And it's just is really, it's its own kind of comfort food to have an acting showcase like this for these two powerhouses.
Well, yeah, it's one of, I don't know why this is such, I feel like this is a generalization that's also true. I feel like this is catnip to a very specific brand of homosexual. Like you said, that being a comfort movie to just titanic actresses going head to head, like Notes on a Scandal.
Oh yeah.
I fucking love Notes on a Scandal, watching Judi Dench and Kate Blanchett go at each other.
Can I do it? You can cut this. It's a Notes on a Scandal tangent. You can say it's real. But so I think our Francesca hadn't seen it before.
Mm.
And so I had an old DVD copy from Blockbuster. And so we put it on. And do you want to know where that fucker stopped? Where it skipped and broke down?
It better not have been the Here I Am breakdown.
It was right before that scene.
That's rude.
And that and Notes on a Scandal is not available to, at the time, was not available to like rent on iTunes. So we had to go on Amazon and rent it. And then watch the final 30 minutes of Notes on a Scandal.
That's like cutting someone out at the knees.
The best scene in the whole movie. And that's when my DVD starts. And maybe it's, I think it's my DVD knew that it knew that I'd been watching it so many times that it was like, oh no, here comes this scene again. I'm out.
We've watched this too many times. I'm done.
Yeah, clearly the DVD was just kind of skipping at one point. It just knew. Anyway, notes. And that's that movie is to me too. It is totally like I put it on because I want to watch some acting.
Yeah. And watching Notes on a Scandal is very different from 1,000 Acres because I don't think you can tell that Judy and Kate are like relishing in that because like playing that type is fun for them.
Yeah.
1,000 Acres is not what I would call fun.
No.
And I don't think you were watching Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer have fun, but you are watching them act exquisitely opposite one another. And that's the same type of just wondrousness that we love from our actresses.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a special type of food for the soul.
Yeah.
For a specific homosexual man.
Another tangent. I feel like that has to have been how Faye Dunaway talked to that stage boy. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, yes.
The little homosexual boy.
Yeah, with the salad, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my. So sort of kicking us off here, this mm-hmm. is sort of an inverted, modernized retelling of King Lear.
Yeah.
And obviously we got to go down our little Shakespeare rabbit hole in our Midsummer episode. But what is your background with King Lear? Like, what is your background with the origin of this?
So I kind of roughly read the play in college because for an acting class assignment in college, we had to pick a classical monologue, I guess. So I did Edmund from King Lear. So yeah, I remember just skimming through the play to find all of Edmund's lines. Because now I'm kicking myself. I'm like, Michael, I would have totally just carved out an afternoon and read King Lear. You couldn't have done that at 21 years old. But no, apparently not. So yes, I know the very kind of, I mean, barely cliff notes. I don't even think I know how King Lear ends. Sorry.
Yeah. It's a lot of death.
I figured as much. But yeah, I never saw that Glinda Jackson revival on Broadway. It didn't get the best notices. So I don't think I didn't seek it out. But yeah, that's really my knowledge of it. What's your history with King Lear, Jerry?
I like King Lear a lot. It's one of my favorites, mainly because of how much I love Goneril and Regan, which maybe explains my affinity for 1,000 Acres, since those are the lead characters essentially of this one.
Yeah.
But I have yet to see a good live production of King Lear. I've seen it twice live, both like non-community, high equity regional houses, and bad. Just two of the worst productions I've seen from those respective companies. So one day maybe I'll see a good King Lear on stage. We can hope.
Yeah. You had said that it's an inverted take on this play. And I remembered all like the YA books I read in high school that inverted Hamlet to Ophelia's perspective. Mm-hmm. Oh, I couldn't get enough of that. Especially because I was really in love with Hamlet in high school and just was so obsessed with that whole thing. I saw a really great college production of it. And my obsession just got so much deeper, and I saw every movie I could find about of it. And any take on the story from Ophelia's perspective, oh yes, I want to know what their take is on it. And so I think that's probably where we're similar in that regard, where we get a different perspective, especially from the women in the story, because especially in a lot of the dramas, you know, they're not titled Lady Macbeth or Goneril or Regan or Ophelia. They're titled after the men. And I was always wanting to know what's going on with these ladies.
This again is probably just the gay in me talking. I always find those characters more interesting. Mm-hmm. Like I in Shakespeare, I normally always find the supporting roles more interesting than the heroes, the title mm-hmm. characters, 9 times out of 10.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love Lady Macbeth. Like the way you're talking about Ophelia, I love Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
Just fascinating character.
I think if I had found that play early on too, I would have been the same way with finding maybe other Lady Macbeth material, but it's tough because Hamlet and Ophelia are much younger than Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. So you can definitely reach a bigger audience with the Hamlet Ophelia than probably the Macbeth and Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's definitely why this was really intriguing to me too.
Yeah, and it does a really good job, I think, of adapting that story. Like I feel a little bad because of this whole project, I have not once read one of the books that the movie is based off of before we do the episode.
I know,
because unfortunately a lot of the books are longer than I have the time for at in our current environment. I'm just going to be upfront about it.
Yeah.
But watching this movie, both times I've watched it, it has ended with me being like, I really need to read this book.
I felt the same way, where I was very interested in seeing what the book would be like. I wonder, do we think that Jessica Lange's voiceovers are taken directly from the book?
She said that there is an interview she did with Charlie Rose around the release of this movie, where like the first 20 minutes of her interview is just about 1,000 Acres. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, first off, one of the things she said was how difficult it was to adapt this just massive layered novel into a streamlined 2-hour movie. That was a big problem, just getting it off the ground. But that a majority of her voiceovers are just verbatim Jane Smiley's prose from the novel.
It's good stuff. Okay, maybe we should jump into the plot of it before we get into the, but it was good. It's especially the way Jessica reads it.
Yes.
Is very, as much as I'm nowadays, I'm iffy about voiceovers. I think more often than not, they're not needed, but it's funny. We've seen a lot of Michelle's movies use them. And I think in this one, it's to good effect. We can't reach the heights of Age of Innocence with Joanne Woodward, but I think these are good voiceovers.
Yes, I think they integrate them very well. And as you said, I think they're delivered very well, which makes me forgive them, because I'm like you, I'm not big on voiceover. I feel like a good amount of the time, it sometimes feels like a cop-out to me. Like, couldn't you have shown me?
Yeah.
But in this case, there's only one part of the movie where the voiceover, I'm just like, oh, we didn't need that here. But a majority of the time, it's a really nice connective tissue especially since it lets us inside Jenny's head a little bit more, the Jessica Lange character, which is sort of where we need to be for this story to land. So I go along with it.
Yeah. Do you want to tell the lovely listeners about A Thousand Acres?
Sure. So A Thousand Acres, as we said, is a take on King Lear from the perspective of the Goneril and Regan characters, the two eldest daughters who in this story are Jenny, Rose, and Caroline, which is Lang, Pfeiffer, Jennifer Jason Leigh. And they are the three daughters of Larry Cook, who is a prominent farmer in Iowa, who decides to sell his farm to a corporation and split the farm into pieces, a la King Lear, and give them to his daughters and his and their husbands. Jenny and Rose are very in favor of this, and Caroline has the misfortune of saying that she has doubts, which causes her father to say, well, if you have doubts, you're out. Cool. So Caroline goes back to her job in Des Moines as a lawyer and sort of leaves the family once again. And then you see Larry's mental capacity is waning.
Yeah.
And he winds up getting in a big blowout fight with both Jenny and Rose, who say, done with you. You're not going to do this to us anymore. Out. Like, farm is ours now. Go.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads to a night on the couch between Jenny and Rose, where Rose tells Jenny that when they were younger, their father raped them for an extended period of time, first Jenny, and then he moved on to Rose. And you sort of start to see how these two women have coped with that over the course of their lives. Rose has remembered everything and is very embittered and angry and has sort of let her rage fuel her the rest of her life, whereas Jenny has very much tamped down these memories and is now having to relive them because of Rose's confrontation with her. And then you have the Colin Firth character, Jess, who's the Edmund character here, who is there really to serve as a catalyst between Jenny and Rose, as he is sleeping with both of them at different points in time. And so that's another sort of wrench in the familial workings. And then once they have extricated Larry from the farm, he turns to Caroline and says, they're mistreating me, I want my farm back, and so sues Jenny and Rose to get the farm back. But once Larry is on the stand, it's very clear that he has lost it completely, and so Jenny and Rose win their suit, but it's a pretty hollow victory because Larry doesn't even know he's lost anything. Mm-hmm. And so Jenny reaches a breaking point where she leaves her husband, Ty, gives her share of the farm to him, and leaves the farm behind. And then Rose, who was a breast cancer survivor, her cancer comes back and she winds up passing away. And Jenny only returns to get Rose's two daughters, so Jenny's nieces. And you learn that Larry passed away not long after Rose did. And Jenny has come back to basically get rid of the farm in whole and take her nieces away and start a new life with them. And we end with them in their U-Haul driving away.
Yeah, I think you covered everything.
I hope so. There, you can tell how many things must be in that book.
Yeah.
And how much deeper it must go from just how much stuff they're trying to cram into this, or not even cram, manage to cram into this sort of hour 50-minute movie.
Yeah, I felt there must have been, and you can do this in a book, there must have been just so much more about Caroline, about Jess. I bet we got so many more scenes with Jess and Ginny, Jess and Rose, the beginning of those two relationships. Scenes with Rose and her husband, scenes with Ginny and her husband. We get away from the two lead sisters. We only get a few bits with each supporting character. I think this could have been better told in a miniseries format almost, the way you could have that time with each character and spend time with these people over a course of 7 or 8 hours. But yeah, it does feel like most of the supporting characters get some stuff, but I wonder if it was either so much was cut or just they couldn't fit it all in.
Yeah, they have definitely boiled down the focus to be about Jenny and Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And while that works on a lot of fronts,
yeah,
it's slightly to the detriment of some of the more deeper and thorny issues at play in this movie, because sometimes it turns them into footnotes when those are actually the parts that deserve a little more exploration than they get.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is one of those things that this movie's an odd beast for me because I recognize its flaws,
mm-hmm.
but I find it so incredibly watchable.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would watch this movie again, because I think we had said to each other, or I had said to you, there are certainly some movies that I have seen of hers that I was not really looking forward to watching a second time. And this was not one of them. I was very excited to revisit this one and sort of find things that I had missed previously and revisit others. And yeah, it's very watchable for me.
I wonder if I will later down the line, if this will be one of those that I'll rewatch for the acting. Yeah, it's a very tough movie to watch. It's really hits at a lot of thorny issues in my life, but what it's doing and what it's saying, I think is really interesting and really important to share with an audience.
And I think they're very lucky, as you said, about the smaller characters. At least they're lucky to have cast such a stacked ensemble that even if they don't have much to play, very few of them are impeded by that. You wish that there was more depth almost because of what a good job they're doing with what little they have.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I think speaks very highly of the performers themselves.
Because, yeah, it's so funny how one of my first notes is about the, I guess, the welcome home barbecue for Jess. And when Colin Firth rolls up and starts speaking in a American accent,
yes.
I said, I've never heard that come out of his mouth before.
No.
I don't really think I've ever seen him play an American. And it sounds a completely different voice to me. Like, who is this man talking? Do they dub his voice? And this is like in his peak, like Mr. Darcy, Bridget Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Very handsome.
This is English Patient, Shakespeare in Love.
Ooh.
Baby, hottie, hot, 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 Colin Firth.
I even wrote down, which one of these ladies is he gonna fuck? I loved it. And then he has a fantastic scene with Jessica where, you know, they start having an affair, and it's when they're in the flatbed, within the flatbed of his truck.
Yeah.
They just have had sex and they're, and he asks, I think he asks, why haven't you had any kids with Ty? And Jessica explains how she's had 5 miscarriages. And it's the scene where you start to realize that there are darker things going on in this movie than just maybe an ornery dad and, you know, oh, we're having a fight about the farm, but, you know, we'll work it out. That's to me where I got the vibe that, oh, something's really going on here. I remember Jessica more in that scene, but Colin Firth too is really pretty, very tender and very sympathetic to her in that scene.
Yeah. I wish that we saw a scene with just him and Michelle Pfeiffer, since Rose is the character he
really
quote unquote winds up with. He winds up leaving her when her cancer returns. But yeah, it's what we see of him is good. Again, makes you wish that he had more.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that way about Jason Robards too. I feel like what he gives us is good, but there's not... Larry comes in short bursts in this movie rather than being sort of a fully defined character.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the one that this hits hardest is Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
Because I don't find Caroline a very, she's very underwritten in this adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's suffering from disappointment, although it's how I felt both times. If this was a first watch, I'd blame it more on that. I just don't think Jennifer Jason Leigh's doing very good work.
Okay.
In this one, she's certainly my least favorite of the principals.
Yeah, I wonder if that's just because we don't get a lot from her, and maybe her performance is a result of that, maybe.
Yeah, I think she's very little is asked of her. But again, I feel like that's to the character and her as a performer's detriment, because she should be having a lot asked of her. Like, she turns on her sisters for what feels like no reason. Again, because we don't get enough with those characters, it kind of comes out of nowhere that suddenly she's swooping back into town, hell-bent on getting your dad's farm back, when we've really seen no rapprochement between her and Larry for her to sort of forgive him kicking her out of the family, essentially.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think what's seen is maybe, oh no, she's just coming to make amends and try to get back into the fold, but we don't see that kind of reconciliation happen. We don't see a lot of the sister dynamic. I'm thinking of that scene, it's after Caroline has expressed her doubts about joining her father's scheme with the farm, and Ginny is giving her advice on how to get back into the fold, you know, just say, go up to be real, talk soft, like say daddy, how she's babying her. And I imagine that happened with Ginny and Rose towards Caroline, but okay, it doesn't give you a lot to go with, work with.
Yeah, and that's the scene for me both times where I've been like, something is amiss here, because just the way you and I are both from the South, we know that women call their fathers daddy no matter what the age, and normally that doesn't like trigger anything in me. It's just how it is. I've heard women in my family say that for years, like it's not a big deal. Yeah. But there's something about how Jessica Lange is sort of coaching Caroline to suck up to their father, and how many times and the way she says daddy, that I'm like, this oogs me out.
Yeah.
And I can't put my finger on why it oogs me out, but it does.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we obviously, again, because they are the lead characters, we certainly get the relationship between Jenny and Rose.
Mm-hmm.
But anything else with Caroline is really up top. We don't see her with her sisters at any point after that.
No, there's no, I think maybe because it's kind of similar with the sisters, but I think of like an August Osage County kind of chat with Barbara, Karen, and Ivy.
Yeah.
I was kind of waiting for one of those, maybe. But no, we don't really get one of those.
Mm-mm.
And maybe before we move on to our two leading ladies, Keith Carradine is great. I think
he's great.
He is. I think he's going to be one of the supporting characters that gets maybe a little bit more than everybody else. Would you agree? Or do you think he's on the same?
I would agree with that. I think he gets lucky because Jessica Lange really is the lead. Like, Jenny is the lead even more so than Rose, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Keith Carradine gets lucky that he's her husband, because I think you get to see more of him purely because of the proximity to that character. On top of the fact that he's sort of the straight arrow pointing north in this one, like claims he's not taking sides, and by all accounts, he's not upspeak, but his constant mentality is that everything he's doing, he's just doing for the farm.
Yeah.
Like, as long as the farm succeeds and as long as their livelihood is intact, he's going to do what it takes to make sure that stays on track. Which, if you are rooting for Jenny in particular, makes him a bit of an asshole at times, frankly.
And yeah, getting to Jenny and Rose, they're definitely kind of opposite, they're opposites. Jenny is described, I think, by Jess as oblivious at one point. Rose, I think Jenny says Rose has always spoken her mind.
Yeah, I like how the two sisters describe each other at certain points, because Jenny says that Rose always says what she thinks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Rose says that Jenny is eternally hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those actresses really lean into sort of that base boiling down of who these women are.
Because mm-hmm. we see it in so many of the of their really big scenes together. They keep those core thesis statements for their characters really intact, you know, especially in the big storm sequence, that big conversation they have on the couch about what their father did to them. Rose is the one delivering it straight. You know, she's holding on, but she's delivering it straight. And Jenny can't quite believe it. She's repressed it so much. And even I think as their arcs through the film, Rose stays straight on the, I'm going to speak my mind till the very end. And I think Jenny holds on to the hope that she can start anew with this younger generation, with Rose's kids. She can let the pain end there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think she maintains the eternal hopefulness, but I don't think she's oblivious any longer.
No, yes, I think her eyes are very much opened.
Yeah.
Yeah, even in that fantastic scene, which I just watched it right before we logged on, so that's why it's fresh in my head, of her when she leaves her husband and goes to work at Denny's and Ty finds her again. And what did he say? You were never like this. Or you, what does he say? You were pretty. You were...
Yeah, you were pretty. You were funny. He's like... He's just describing this sort of man's ideal wife. And it's very, very borderline condescending he preferred her oblivious.
And she's, you know, I was a ninny. I was a simp.
She says I was an idiot.
Yeah, she's an idiot.
And then follows that up with I was a simpleton.
Yeah, simpleton. Yeah.
And yeah, like, I feel like that should be a very sad confession. That she's lived her life that long, or realizing that she lived her life that long sort of in that haze, but it's also fairly liberating for her, it feels like, because just before that he had made some crack because she had sort of ended the conversation and was going back to her shift, and he said, oh, you always have to have the last word, and she kind of turns and just like, fuck you, like, say the last thing, I don't care.
Last word. I don't give a shit.
Yeah. And that's what he follows up with is you were pretty, you were funny. And she just shuts it down. Like, it's just like, no, you're describing what you thought were really wonderful characteristics. And for me, they weren't. They were bad for me.
Yeah. And they kept me in the dark for so long. And they, kept me in just this unhealthy place.
Yeah, and it's just really beautiful, subtle work from Jessica Lange.
And I don't know if, but up to this point, because we've definitely seen it later on in her career, but up to this point, I don't think we had seen Michelle maybe in as bitter, angry as this.
No, I think I would say the closest you could probably get would be Elvira.
Yeah.
In Scarface.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Elvira has a lot more, or it feels like she has a lot more agency about her than Rose does. Rose's ambition seems to be staked in the farm because that's all she has. She is very stuck.
Yeah.
Whereas Elvira chooses where she is. I mean, when she reaches her breaking point, she pieces out. She doesn't have to stay there.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what Michelle is bringing here feels very, very much prepping for Oleander.
Yeah.
Leaning into that darkness and being okay with leaning into that darkness.
I was just thinking about with Rose and her circumstances. It makes a lot of sense to me that she would want to make sure she has an ally in her sister, because it really is all she has. She wants to keep a united front and keep this intact. I think to stick it to her father, to gain something back from this experience that she's lived her whole life with, but also she wants it back because this is all she's got. It's tougher for her to branch out. Like Jenny doesn't have kids. She doesn't have as much of a stake in the farm without her father. So yeah, the tragedy of Rose is that she's stuck and she's just trying to still make this work. Even though she remembers everything, she even says she has her eyes peeled. She's always looking around this whole movie, but yet she can't find that way out. There is no way out for her to find, I guess.
She's ever watchful, and that is why her end is so sad. And as we sort of said, it's one of the things that I wish was more deeply explored is the fact that once they get the farm, Rose feels this freedom to be able to tell every one of their neighbors, everyone in this community, exactly what their father did.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody believes her. And the only reason why we find this out is via Jenny's voiceover. And again, we're watching these films with a 2021 perspective. But it even feels like in 97 that deserved some sort of deeper exploration than just having it become this footnote in the story. Because like I said, it is very clear, especially because of the voiceover, that Jenny is the primary lead of this.
Mm-hmm.
But Rose is a secondary lead. I don't consider her supporting by any stretch. So I feel like that character deserved a little bit better than the hand she got there at the tail end.
Yeah, I would agree. She points out the hypocrisy in the community and her kind of drunk by the side of the road speech, where, you know, her father can walk into the community and be labeled a king, even though he's caused his daughters so much pain, and they're just labeled the bitches and that's it. I think that could have been made gone even deeper with that. See her in the community, see her try to set the record straight and just be met with that hypocrisy again.
Yeah, that is my favorite scene between the two of them. And that's relatively hard to pick because I really do think like their three extended scenes together are all pretty fantastic between Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer. But that scene where they start off on the porch and are sort of talking about their circumstances, and then it just sort of devolves into this very interesting conversation because Rose lets it slip that she is now in a relationship with Jess. And it's actually probably the first time you see Rose happy in this entire movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because she's getting to talk about how free she feels with Jess, and he makes her feel beautiful, particularly since when she got her mastectomy, her husband basically said, "Don't ever be naked in front of me again.
You'd rather I keep my robe
naked
on."
Yeah. And it's, so you see Rose happy and you see Jenny just internally breaking down. It's a very interesting swap to watch because Rose is now so free, whereas she had been so careful previously. And now Jenny, who sort of seems to foam at the mouth, just sort of trying to fill the silence with whatever is in her head, is now sort of playing chess in her head and trying not to let how hurt she is come out. And when they're on the side of the road and Jenny finally asks, like, did you know that I was sleeping with Jess? And Rose admits that she knows now, but didn't when they started up. Mm-hmm. And Jessica Lange just kind of looks at her and she says, I guess that means he and I don't have anything private together. And I kind of want to know if that's a line directly from the book, because it's an odd way of putting that, but it's also just so beautiful and heartbreaking, because she had kind, you can tell this was like her fun, dirty secret.
Yeah.
And that had made her really happy, and now it's gone. Yeah. And it just punches you in the face.
Yeah. I bet it's from the book. It's too pretty, I think, to be not from a book.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It was the one thing she could have divorced from her family.
Yeah.
But no, nothing really ever was. And yeah, that's so, that is very heartbreaking.
Yeah, and going back to sort of Michelle and how careful, and what, going back to what you were saying about how she states she always has her eyes peeled, which is in regard to why her two girls are at boarding school.
Yeah.
So that she doesn't have to keep them around her dad. You see that. That's another one of those things that Rose tells on herself about, that Michelle is carried all the way through, because you see her in these scenes with Jenny almost as if she's waiting for this dam to break. Kind of like you said, that united front, it's like Rose is gauging the right time to just crack this wide open. Mm-hmm. And so there's the scene where they're folding the bed sheet, yeah, where you see Rose asking Jenny questions and then just not even blinking, laser focused on her to gauge her response. And she does the same thing before she tells Jenny about their father's raping them, mm-hmm, is she's always just gauging. And then you see her finally give up and it's just like, no, this is what happened. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that Michelle cries this entire film.
No, it's tears up, but never, no, those dams never break either.
And that was the other sort of delineation between the two sisters, is that Rose never goes to tears, and that seems to be Jenny's default. Because even at the end of that entire scene, again, Michelle's eyes, I can't even remember what she's responding to verbatim, what Jenny says, but it's essentially kind of believing Rose, but not believing Rose about herself. And you see in, mm-hmm, Michelle's eyes that kind of, like, for 2 seconds, she kind of feels betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And then she kind of shrugs it off and hugs her sister and says, don't make me feel sorry for myself.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's really great watching them play sisters and play off each other, because they have a really wonderful chemistry and are able to just balance each other out really well. Like, they always know the next move from the other person and are ready to accept it. And it's just, like we said at the top, it's just really fantastic to watch two talented actresses play off each other like this.
And yeah, and that scene in the, where they're folding the laundry together, yeah, that's one that when I first watched, I think I rewound it, because the way they're able to put so much into those little bits of dialogue, and knowing and seeing how watchful Rose was in that scene, I couldn't figure out, I was like, why is she looking at Ginny like that? And why is Ginny avoiding, why is she skirting? I couldn't figure it out. It all makes so much sense later on in the movie. But yeah, they're just so, they really did their homework in figuring out where the landmines are that Ginny is going to tiptoe around, where the lines that Rose wants to get right up to the edge with. Yeah, it's really compelling.
Well, because Jenny certainly seems to have fallen into this sort of pseudo wife for their father. She meets him out in the field every morning. She's the one that makes him breakfast. She's sort of taken the place of their mother who died young.
Yeah.
And so it sort of seems to also be Rose testing that, because Jenny does seem to be the most loyal to their father, even though by the end, it's seemingly Caroline. Again, if Caroline were more present, we'd probably get a better sense of that. But from what we have in the adaptation, it seems that Jenny is the most loyal of the three.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the most docile of the three in terms of what their father prefers in a daughter.
Oh gosh, even looking at the storm scene, I forgot that I'd written this down with Michelle. When they're kind of seeing their father kind of wander out into the storm in the middle of the night, she says, "I hope he dies in it." That was also a huge tell for me. I'm like, oh, this goes more beyond just, you know, kicking your sister out of the family. This runs so much, this so deeper.
Yeah, she pulls no punches, because even in that scene with the laundry, she says she hates her father and then follows it up with to Jenny, "And sometimes I hate you too." Mm-hmm. Just because it's almost like she's sticking around just because Jenny is there.
I think this is at the end of the courtroom scene, when she wants to rub it in Larry's face that she's won. I think Jenny tries to stop her and say, "Well, what do you want, Rose? Blood?" She says, "I want him to know that he lost, that he didn't win, that he didn't get us." But again, like you said, it's the most hollow victory. And it's just, she's going to have to sit with this anger until she dies. She even says it. She says, "We're going to be angry until we die." And it's tough as a viewer to watch her till the end and she doesn't get that closure you really want. She sticks to her conviction that she said she didn't forgive the unforgivable. But still, it's like, oh, it's painful.
Yeah.
That's a painful way to end your character. It's, in one way, it's fantastic because that's life. But still, as a movie watcher, it just hits you right there.
I also, did you notice that to a point when Jenny leaves Ty, she starts living the life that Rose imagined their mom did?
Yeah, that's right.
In the storm scene, what kicks it off is Rose imagining their mother actually didn't die, that she just ran away and was living somewhere, working as a waitress with a new name, and was going to come back to them one day. And I did not pick up on that the first viewing, but this one I was just like, and Jenny does exactly that. She leaves and works as a waitress.
And does come back for Rose in a way. She comes back for a part of Rose's heart.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not pick up that at all. Oh, look at you putting pieces together.
I know. I for some reason, it was watching Jessica Lange and that Denny's name tag that I was just, it clicked with me. So I made a note about that.
Oh, if Jessica was my Denny's waitress, I'd be going every day at Denny's.
Yes.
Yes. Same thing every day. Do you have anything else before we go into like the making of this one? Because this had a pretty interesting road to the screen.
I don't think so. I liked the ending. I liked that, you know, aside from the shortcomings we've already talked about, I did like that it sort of ended with Jenny still saying, "I see hope," and sort of following up on the instructions of Rose that all this just end with them, like, Mm-hmm. Farm is gone. Sell it off so you can take the money after I pass. Take my daughters, and this is it.
The way there's some beautiful shots of the farm and of their land, really pretty shots. And right at the end there, we're panning through the property. And there's something about the way that the only thing that was lit, you really, I guess, because of the shadows from the wind, the shadows from the window, or the light coming through, the windows keep the rest of the house in shadow. So all we see are just these kind of windows of sky, of trees.
Yeah.
You know, all we're seeing is the hope. We're not seeing the house that wrought so much pain and grief. And we're just seeing the light at the end of these kind of tunnels, if you think about it.
Yeah, I think that's what I got for this one.
Yeah. So Jessica and Michelle both read a galley of this book like around the same time, right?
Yeah, before it was even published, they read it in galley form and responded very positively to it. And both of them even said that they had never met each other, but knew they wanted to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And this one just sort of fell in their lap while they were both working for their separate production companies, basically right next door to each other at the Orion offices. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they knew they wanted to do this movie together in 91.
Yeah.
And it got released in 97.
Bit of a long road to the screen. Ugh.
But this is Pulitzer Prize winner. So they knew they wanted to do it even before it was a prize-winning novel.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, like I said, listening to Jessica Lange talk about it, it seemed like a big hurdle was just the script and making sure that it was a clearly defined story and what could be cut, what needed to be cut just to keep it trucking, because even she said that this is a story that needs to move like a freight train.
Yeah.
And
I think I was worried it would get stuck. I think I was really worried that it would be kind of interminably slow. I had a bit of a fear of that that doesn't happen in this. But
no,
I was worried that it could.
It definitely could, but it from the written accounts that are out there, it feels like Jocelyn Morehouse, the director, also had a very special affinity for the book and kind mm-hmm. of carried it around set with her, kind of like a Bible for this one. And while again, this was produced by Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer's companies. Also, happy last Via Rosa movie episode.
Happy last Via Rosa episode.
This is our last Via Rosa movie to cover. But the overarching production company was Touchstone, which is a branch of Disney. And you know, the rape and the incest on a Disney brand, there were some headbutting about what could be included and what couldn't for this property.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to, from all accounts, I'm trying to get the timeline right, because from what it sounds like, Jessica Lange was in London doing Streetcar, got what for all intents and purposes was the director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
And she said outright that it was confusing, could not make sense of the story. And so all they asked for was for a second editor to come in. And basically just no reshoots, nothing like that, just a second editor to come see if they could make a more coherent through line for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just basically fresh set of eyes.
Yeah.
And one scene in particular that Jocelyn Morehouse was very attached to was a segment where Jenny almost poisons Rose with like tainted sausage.
Yeah.
Which again makes sense because Goneril poisons Regan at the end of King Lear. So when I read that that was in the movie, I was just like, this tracks.
Yeah.
I believe that that is part of that story, but did not make sense in the journey of this specific adaptation. When that scene got cut, Jocelyn Morehouse basically walked. And so even though we have the movie with her name still on it, directed by, because it was, like, again, by all accounts, there were no reshoots, so everything in the movie is directed by her. She was done with this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting because Michelle Pfeiffer also went on Charlie Rose. So it was interesting hearing these actresses talk about this movie because Jessica Lange, to a certain point, said exactly what we did. She said,
is it the film about... I had wished it was
yeah.
from day one?
No.
No. Am I pleased with it? Yes. And what I am pleased with is what I do believe succeeds are the performances.
That's exactly what people say.
Yeah. On every level. I mean, like I said, Jason is wonderful. Michelle is great.
Keith is wonderful.
Solid. Yeah. I mean, really touching, right. I think. And, you know, Kevin, Pat Hingle, all down the line, I think the performances
yeah.
are little gems.
She basically said, this movie works because of the work the actors are doing. And I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had Michelle being kind of cagey with Charlie Rose, who asked her the ever popular question of, you know, you're your hardest critic. What's a role that you were not happy with? And she kind of softballs it and is just like, I'm not going to answer that. And he pushes her on it and she says, okay, I'll tell you a character's name. And she says,
Rose.
Which one was that?
Come on.
I don't know. I can't remember.
It was Thousand Acres. And really? It was something, yeah. And it was a project that I was, you know, deeply passionate about. Right. And a novel I loved. And I didn't. I don't feel that I did.
Did you feel that?
And I blame it all on... No, I'm kidding.
She is not happy with her performance in Thousand Acres. Yeah. That it is not what she was wanting it to be. And knowing that this movie was made because these two women were so passionate about it, it is a little bit of a shame that they got it off the ground, put 6 years into it from reading the novel to release, and aren't happy with the product. That's just gotta hurt. Even though we as audience members, and I'm certain we are not the only ones, think that they are absolutely fantastic in it.
I think there probably are their harshest critics at the end of the day. And we've she said the same thing about Ellen Olenska. She's saying it about Rose. I'm not having it. But I think I would agree with Jessica. I would go with her point of view. It doesn't seem like it's the movie that they intended, but you watch it for what they're doing. And I think that's, and honestly, if it gets us interested in the book as well, I mean, it clearly made us want to go out and find copies. So I think it does what it's supposed to do, where we've engaged with it, and we maybe want to check out Jane Smiley's source material. I think that's pretty good for...
Yeah, it is certainly a strong enough adaptation to make me want to check out the book almost immediately to find out even more about the story.
Yeah, but it's a shame that it almost seems like it's the... Is it the big production companies, the media conglomerates' fault for... Or is it even the fault? They're trying to make a cohesive... film. This is what they think they need to do.
I was about to say, it felt like from everyone else's perspective, the second editor was needed in order to get a better film, a film that actually made sense. This does not seem like a story that could survive if people found it confusing. And if you have an actress who participated in the movie watching it and saying, this is confusing.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Because if it was confusing and you have the plot of this story, I think you're, it's going to be DOA. So. Yeah.
It sounds like for all the parts available, we got the best possible outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I said, this will not be the last time I watch this movie.
Yeah. They've done their job in my book.
Yes, of course. So you want to talk some awards?
This is quite a good year for awards, I have to say.
This is an outstanding year for awards.
This is the year of Titanic.
Yes. So to get some smaller awards out of the way, all three of the sisters won a Best Actress Award at what is known as the Verona Love Screens Film Festival.
Okay.
Could find nothing else, but they won it. And then Jessica Lange, have you heard of the Yoga Awards?
No, I've never heard of the Yoga Awards.
So it is kind of like the Spanish Razzies, and like their best in film is the Goya Awards, so their worst is the Yoga Awards.
Oh, it's just...
And Jessica Lange won Worst Foreign Actress. But it was for three movies. It was for this, Hush, and Cousin Bette. I have not seen Hush or Cousin Bette, but you lumping this one in with those just to give her Worst Actress, I question your taste, Yoga Awards.
Yeah, I'll be having words with the Yoga Awards from a decision they made back in 1997.
Jessica Lange did get nominated for a Best Actress Drama at the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
For this performance. And she was up against Dame Judi Dench, who was the winner for Mrs. Brown, Helena Bonham Carter for Wings of the Dove, Kate Winslet for Titanic, and Jodie Foster for Contact.
I have not seen Mrs. Brown or The Wings of the Dove.
I have not seen Wings of the Dove, but I have seen Mrs. Brown.
And Judy was pretty... That was like her big, at least breakout in America, it seems.
Yeah, that was her kickoff. And she is great in it.
Yeah.
Like that's just a solid lineup right there.
Crosses all kind of genres too, because you've got like the two period pieces, this big epic romance, and then a science fiction movie. And then you've got Jessica Lange with
like a Thousand Acres.
Drama. Yeah. We're really crossing off a lot of things.
So I do think that while I like them both, I do think Jessica Lange is the better performance in this movie.
I think so too.
Because looking at that lineup of five, I don't think there's anyone I would take out to put Michelle in.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jessica Lange does not move on to the Oscars. That is Helen Hunt, who was the winner that year for As Good As It Gets. Dame Judy, HBC, Kate Winslet again, and then Julie Christie coming out of nowhere for Afterglow.
Oh gosh, okay.
Which is the one from that lineup that I have not seen.
Dang, somebody did though. She came out of nowhere.
Well, yeah, because that was still like the infancy of the SAG Awards, and I was surprised that Julie Christie didn't show up there, because I would have assumed she would have been around for some precursor, especially since the SAG had six nominees.
Oh, okay.
That year.
I think I still would have put Jessica Lange in this category for the Golden Globes, even though I think she and Michelle are co-leads. Yeah, I think it really is Ginny's story, I think, or Ginny's view that we're seeing this through. And I think,
well, that's the thing, you know, if this were released like post 2011,
Michelle
would have been supporting.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This was the age before outright category fraud on a yearly basis.
And looking at that supporting lineup, I mean, those are all
again, no wiggle room. whatsoever.
Oh, honey, you can't take Sigourney Weaver out for the ice storm. Not over your dead body.
Right, and that's just Golden Globes. I mean, at the Oscars, you've got Kim Basinger, Joan Cusack, Julianne Moore, Gloria Stewart, and Minnie Driver.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just across the board, you've got fantastic. Mm-hmm. This was just a great year for actresses.
Yeah, for sure. But I am glad that Jessica, I was surprised to see that she got the Golden Globe nomination. This doesn't seem like it. I can just imagine this sunk without a trace, but it found its little places.
Yeah, and I feel like, shockingly, they may have needed to look a little deeper in drama.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know we're talking the 90s, so obviously Jodie Foster was still very popular at this point. Mm-hmm. But throwing her in that for Contact feels like a little bit of a curveball, to the point where it's just like, maybe they had some slots where they really had to do some looking to get a solid five for drama this year, which it seems like lately has been what they've had to do for musical comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's so rare that we see, like, with a Jodie's nomination, where it's that really big genre, they're really digging in. It's almost as if I wish they would make a pick like that again with some of these sci-fi horror films.
Especially, I mean, who knows when we're going to get another Golden Globes, but...
Oh, true.
You know, especially since they do have so much more... I don't even know the word. I had it on the tip of my tongue. They just, with the split between drama and musical comedy, it feels like they have a lot more freedom
mm-hmm.
to showcase genre pictures than sort of the just streamlined five we get at the SAG and Oscars that always tend to skew dramatic. Like, Oscars is where we even tend to lose comedies nine times out of 10.
Yeah. So I'm glad they dug around a bit for this.
Yeah.
Because I think Jessica's totally deserving.
Yes, that is a nomination-worthy performance.
Yeah. I'm not going to give the Golden Globes a lot of credit, but I give them credit for their 1997.
So I think we know the answer to this, but would you recommend this movie?
Yes. Yes, I would. If you can find it.
And then where are we landing on Michelle? Just our Michelle ranking for this one.
Oh, I hope I could see. I've let me see where she is on my list right now. Oh, yeah. So she's like number 16 on my list right now for this one.
Oh. Yeah, she's 23 for me.
Okay.
Not too far behind.
Okay.
I really am. By the time we reach our Pfeiffer finale, I'm going to have to do a really hard look at these rankings and make sure they're correct.
Well, I hope we'll go kind of by film, be like, okay, Jerry, what's your number 50? What's your number 50, Michael? That's what I hope we do. I want to see how we because what I love is I think we've ranked them pretty differently. I think we were pretty much for maybe the first half of this simpatico. But now I think we've really gone off in different directions with it. And I think it's really exciting.
I think by the time we hit like number 15 and below, it's just anybody's guess.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be lots of yelling, I think.
Yeah.
What?
How can that be at 27? What the fuck?
That's a 27, but this is a 12. Oh yeah, you're going to hate. I'm looking at it now. You're going to hate my top 10. Ooh, you're going to be so mad at me.
Why would I hate your top 10? You said that's where we match.
Well, like, no, this is like the first, like, 15th. That is, the top 10 has morphed and changed over the last 20 or so.
Are you telling me that Falling in Love Again is now your number one?
I don't know. Stay tuned for the finale. Oh
God. I will cut that episode off faster than you can possibly imagine.
And what's your number five, Michael? Falling in love.
So does that mean it is time for the 6 degrees?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, listeners, we end every one of our episodes with the little game we like to call 6 degrees of Michelle Pfeiffer. And that is where we give each other an actor or actress, and we have to connect them back to Michelle via other actors and actresses in 6 degrees or less. Michael, I cannot for the life of me remember who went first last time, so it is your call. Would you like to give or receive first?
I'll give first.
Okay.
I'm just double checking here right now to make sure that my one for you has not been in a film with Michelle, and it looks like that is the case. I am giving you her fellow nominee for 1998, Jodie Foster. Not her fellow nominee, her co-stars.
What the fuck just came out of your mouth?
Her, Michelle's co-star in 1,000 Acres, Jessica Lange, her fellow nominee in the Golden Globes this year, Jodie Foster. Does that make sense?
I feel like 3 degrees just fell out of your mouth in no particular order. Just word vomited all over the place.
Ugh.
So I'm connecting Jodie Foster. Is that what I'm being led to believe?
Yes. If you got that from everything I just said, bravo.
And correct me, Robert De Niro is still off the table, right?
Yes, let's keep him off the table.
Okay, so I can't use Taxi Driver. Okay. Okay. So Michelle is in I Am Sam with Diane Huist.
Oh, sure.
Who is in Little Man Tate with Jodie Foster.
Oh, there we go.
Thanks to my boyfriend for showing me Little Man Tate this year. Otherwise, I would not have known that.
Good job, Elliot. Coming in. Coming in clutch.
All right. So for you, I am giving you Taraji P. Henson.
Okay.
Feel like he must have come very close because you just made the scrunchy face to end all scrunchy face.
I did. Oh, perfect. Let's see. Oh gosh, I'm going like Benjamin Button, Hidden Figures, in those directions. I'm trying to figure out a way. And I'm like the one time I can't think of like any Octavia Spencer movie. Okay.
You can think of at least one other Octavia Spencer movie besides.
Oh yeah, I'm sure I think of
Hidden Figures.
Where I can get there. Okay, so Taraji P. Henson was in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button with Tilda Swinton, who was in Michael Clayton with George Clooney, who was in One Fine Day with Michelle.
Very nice. We love Tilda. We've used her before.
Maybe does she need to be off the table here pretty soon? Never. No. Never.
No, we've used her. That's maybe the second time, but it's always been to connect her to George Clooney.
Okay. I know. And once again, here I am trying to challenge myself in the most low stakes game in the world.
It's very important to you, Michael.
I know.
All right, Pfeiffer fans, this has been another episode of Pfeiffer Fridays. I'm Jerry Downey, and you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at JerryDowney913.
And I'm Michael McLean, and you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Michael D. McLean.
You can find updates about the podcast by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Pfeiffer Fridays. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast channel is. It makes us easier to find so we can continue to spread the Michelle gospel to one and all. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you again next week for Pfeiffer Fridays.
I don't mean when we got strapped or whipped. I mean when he went into your room at night.
don't remember that.
You were 15, you must remember.
Well, Grandpa Cook used to prowl around the house that night looking at everybody. It was kind of like checking the hogs or something.
It wasn't like checking the hogs with Daddy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pfeiffer Fridays, where we walk you through the films of one Michelle Pfeiffer, and every F-word has an automatic... Oh, Jesus Christ, we're going to start that over again. I'll put that on the blooper reel. You can laugh, Michael. It's fine.
You're having a difficult week.
I should know that by heart by now, but I was toggling back to the Wikipedia page for the cast list, and my brain was just like, what is the next word?
And every F for album.
Every F for album. Oh. Huh. Silent P. All right, take two.